everybody for coming and turning out in extraordinary enthusiastic force for one of our fabulous visiting fellows this year, Alex Watson. We've been so excited to have Alex come back. We've been thinking, oh, it would be really good if we get Alex Watson to come and spend some time at the Hindi Studies Centre. He's great. And so we finally succeeded, and you've come from all the way from Ashoka University. Alex is a specialist in many different areas of Indian philosophy, and previously from here, from Oxford. And we're very happy to have you back speaking today on the self-no self debate. I turn over to you.
Thank you, Jessica, for that generous introduction. There's a handout which is not necessary to follow, it's just sort of supplementary. So, the title, as you can see, is The Self, No Self Debate in Classical Indian Philosophy, Difficulties for the Buddhist. I thought, since I'm giving this lecture in the Hindu Studies Centre, I'd highlight some difficulties for the Buddhist. And what I'll do is three things. In the first part, I'll give an account of the debate between Nyaya and Buddhism about the self, no self debate. And Buddhism I'll be using in this talk just to refer to one particular strand of Buddhism, Dharmakirtian Buddhism, which can be seen as beginning not necessarily with Dharmakirti, because he inherits so much from Dignaga and from Vasubandhu's Abhidharma Kosha Bhasha. But that's the branch of Buddhism that was engaged in by the non-Buddhists when they engaged Buddhism in debate. So in the first part, I'll look at what I think is at stake in this debate. In the second part, I'll give a Nyaya argument against the Buddhist Anatmavada. And in the third part, I'll look at three new arguments by Ramakanta against the Buddhist no-self view. And they're new in these two senses, that no one to my knowledge had put them forward before Ramakanta, and they hadn't been mentioned in the secondary literature prior to my work on this little studied author. Okay, so let's go straight to the first part, Nyaya versus Buddhism. And I like here to make a threefold distinction between three ways in which the self was conceived of by Nyayikas, by Nyaya philosophers, and three corresponding ways in which it was challenged by Buddhists. So we have self as unitary essence, self as owner of certain qualities or substance, in which qualities inhere, and finally self as agent or kartri. So let's go straight to self as unitary essence. In these two diagrams, one under Nyaya and one under Buddhism, they're supposed to represent timelines. So on the left of the diagram is T1. As you proceed forward through time, you move right in the diagram, and the straight line is just intended to show that for Nyaya, our self is something that persists through time, persists unchanging through time. Okay, so the people who've just arrived, you haven't missed anything very important. We're just looking at the debate between Nyaya and Buddhism. Nyaya putting forward Atmavada, the view that there is a self, there is an Atman. Buddhist putting forward Anatmavada, the view that there is no self. And I'm saying that we can separate out three different ways in which Nyayikas, that's Nyaya philosophers, conceived of the self, which correspond to three different ways in which Buddhists challenged the idea of no self. And we're just on the first one, self as unitary essence. In other words, self as something which persists through time, as numerically identical through time. That's supposed to be represented by this line under Nyaya. It's one thing. As you move forward in time to the right, it continues with an unchanging nature and without being broken up into discrete instances. Whereas for Buddhism, what we are in one moment is not what we are in the next moment. In one moment, we're a particular association of a mental state and a bodily state. And then in the next moment, we're a different association of a different mental state and a different bodily state. And according to these Dharmakirtian Buddhists, who, like many other Buddhists, espoused the theory of momentariness, there is nothing that continues to exist from each moment to the next moment. And it so happens that Buddhism dissolves the unity of the person or the self, not only diachronically but even synchronically. So it's the case for these Buddhists that not just over time are we plural, but even at one moment of time we're not one thing but five things. Particular state of the body and then four mental states, which together comprise the five Buddhist skandhas. I mispronounced that, skandhas. So, I think that's all we need for self as unitary essence. Next is the idea of self as the owner of qualities, or the substance in which qualities inhere. So here the big circle underneath Nyaya represents the self, and the small circles represent what were claimed by Nyaya to be qualities of the self: pleasure, pain, desire, aversion, consciousness. Whereas for Buddhists, consciousness and the other skandhas exist together as part of a conglomeration, but they don't inhere in anything else, they don't belong to anything else, they're an irreducible plurality. Five things which happen to occur at the same time in the same place, but are not grounded in any unity. And finally, self as agent. So Nyayikas and also Vaisheshikas compared the self to a puppeteer controlling and instigating bodily movements of the puppet by pulling strings. So similarly, the self, just as a puppeteer does that, according to Nyayikas and Vaisheshikas, the self does the same thing. It instigates and controls bodily movement. Well, for Buddhism, what is the agent of bodily movements? Well, for Buddhism to ask what the agent is to ask nothing more than just what the cause is. And the cause of this bodily movement as I move my right hand, should be careful not to hit anyone, is simply what causes it, namely the moment of intention immediately preceding the bodily movement in the stream of consciousness. And that moment of intention is itself caused and conditioned by the previous moment of consciousness. So there's no unconditioned agent standing above the stream of psychophysical events. And the self is the agent for Nyaya and Vaisheshika, not only in the sense of the instigator of bodily movement, but also in the sense of the agent of our mental actions, perceiver of our perceptions, thinker of our thoughts, cognizer of our cognitions. So if these blue circles represent not physical movements but mental actions, well, for Buddhism, there is no thinker other than the thought. The perceiver just is that particular perception. The thing doing the cognizing, the thing doing the perceiving, is simply that particular moment of consciousness. So one of the reasons that I think these three aspects of selfhood are distinguishable — it's not a distinction that had been made in the secondary literature prior to me — one of the reasons I think it's that we do have three separable things here is that the Buddhist rejections of these three are all particular instances of different general Buddhist views. So the rejection of the self as a unitary essence that persists over time is just a special instance of the Buddhist theory of momentariness. These Buddhists held that everything is momentary, objects of perception as well, everything that exists is momentary, so of course when they apply that to the self, they reach the conclusion that the self too is momentary, i.e. it isn't actually a self. The rejection of the self as substance or owner is just a special case of the Buddhist rejection of substances over and above qualities. So this diagram actually underneath Nyaya could represent a mango. The big circle is the mango substance. The five small circles are proper taste, smell, colour, the five qualities that correspond to our five sense faculties. Whereas for Buddhism, if I want to represent what a mango is for Buddhism, I'd use that diagram. It's five separate things, five tropes, we could say, five qualities, which exist together at the same time in the same place, but do not inhere in anything beyond themselves. And the Buddhist rejection of the self as agent is a special case of the Buddhist view that there is nothing unconditioned that stands over and above the network of causes and effects that comprise the world. Okay, we can now look at what was the principal Nyaya argument against the Buddhist theory of no-self, at least until the end of the first millennium. It's the argument that we find elaborated in the commentaries on Nyaya Sutra 1110. So, it's an argument which asks us to envisage a situation in which you feel pleasure from a certain kind of object that you haven't experienced before. Let's say a tasty kind of food that you haven't encountered before. And then sometime later, a few weeks later, you see an object of that kind, and hence you feel desire for it. Now, both sides agree that this happens. This is uncontroversial, that we frequently feel desire for things that have previously caused us pleasure. But the Nyayika point is that this would not happen were it not for the pleasure, the seeing, and the desire all having one common agent. So why does the Nyayika think that's the case? Well, the Nyayika points to a situation involving two people, person X and person Y. And the pleasure occurs to person X, and at some time subsequently in a different part of the world, person Y sees an object of that kind. Well, in that case, it's clear that person Y would not experience desire as a result of this earlier pleasure. Person Y doesn't even have access to memories of the earlier pleasure. So the Nyayika puts forward these two situations for our comparison and concludes that the reason desire arises in figure 1 but not in figure 2 is because in figure 1 we're dealing with one continuous agent, and in figure 2 we're not. We're dealing with two separate agents. And if that's the case, then if one person were not, as depicted in figure 1, one continuously existing agent, as maintained by Nyaya, but were rather a sequence of distinct subjects of experience, as depicted in figure 3 and as maintained by the Buddhists, if that were the case, if figure 3 were the correct depiction of what one person is, then desire would not arise in this case. Because the thing seeing, the moment of consciousness above S in figure 3, is not the thing which experienced the earlier pleasure. So why would it feel desire towards something that did not cause pleasure for it, for them? For a moment of consciousness, I'll go with it. So that's the argument. Is that, before we discuss it, is that at least clear? The point is that since desire does not arise in figure 2, it would not arise in figure 3, because in both cases we're dealing with separate subjects of experience, experiencing the pleasure and later seeing the object. So this argument, I think, is not very difficult for the Buddhists to reply to, because the argument gains its plausibility from falsely likening the figure 2 situation and the figure 3 situation. The crucial point in the argument was that desire would not arise in figure 3 because it does not arise in figure 2. But the Buddhist has perfectly adequate means at their disposal for distinguishing these two situations. Namely, that in figure 2 there's no line of continuous causation running from the earlier pleasure to the later seeing, whereas in figure 3 there is a line of continuous causation running from the earlier pleasure to the later seeing. And since there is a continuous line of causation in figure 3, all the Buddhist has to assert is that the pleasure in figure 3, if it's a significant enough pleasure to be rememberable later, will lay down a memory trace of itself in the next moment, the second blue circle along in figure 3. And as the stream of consciousness unfolds with each moment giving rise to a replica of itself in the next moment, that giving rise to a replica of itself in the next moment will include giving rise to a replica of the memory trace included in each moment of consciousness. So in that way, a memory trace can be passed along the chain from the earlier pleasure going forward, so that when an object of that kind is seen at the S moment, this memory trace can be activated, the subject can experience memory of the earlier pleasure, and hence desire can arise. And these memory traces, which Buddhists call bhavana or vasana, and Nyayikas call samskara, these are not appealed to by the Buddhist here in some ad hoc way to get the Buddhist out of this problem. No, these are accepted by both sides of the debate to be what explains how it is that we can remember experiences that we had previously, experiences that have ceased. And they're accepted by both sides to be what explains how it is that a karmic result can take place as a result of an action that occurred in the past. The action has ceased to exist, but the action gave rise to a trace, a samskara or a vasana. So I think the only way this argument can work for the Nyayika is if it is definitely the case that in figure 2 the reason the desire does not arise is because we're dealing with two separate subjects of experience. If that were the case, then it would be true that desire would not arise in figure 3, because for the Buddhist we are dealing with separate subjects of experience. But the Buddhist has a perfectly plausible alternative explanation for why desire does not arise in figure 2. For the Buddhist, the reason desire does not arise is not because we're dealing with two separate agents, it's because there's no continuous line of causation. And there is in figure 3. And as long as that remains as a possibility, as long as that's a plausible possibility and hasn't yet been refuted, then the Buddhist has no problem explaining why desire does not arise in figure 2, but can arise in figure 3. So I don't think this Nyayika argument really causes the Buddhist to have to rethink much. The Buddhist just has to articulate another aspect of their theory in order to answer this objection. So let's look at now Ramakanta's argument. Just a little bit, very briefly, about Ramakanta. He was writing in Kashmir in the 10th century. His tradition was not Nyaya, but Shaiva Siddhanta. And a lot of philological work is required to understand his philosophical arguments. His philosophical texts have not been well edited. You can't really understand the arguments from the printed editions. You have to look at manuscripts and parallel passages, and there aren't any translations of his work. And there wasn't even, I think, any mention of his philosophy in histories of Indian philosophy prior to my two books about him. So what's his position? His position is that the Buddhist is right. that there is no self-substance over and above consciousness. And the Buddhist is also right that there is no self-agent over and above consciousness. So how can he preserve the existence of the self? Well, he equates self and consciousness. For him, consciousness constitutes the self. Consciousness is the swabhava of the self, the core nature of the self. And there is no self over and above consciousness. So it's not like, as for Nyaya, where the relationship between consciousness and the self is a kind of hierarchical one, with the self being a substance and consciousness being a quality that inheres in the substance. No, these two are equated for Dharmakanta. And what that means is that Dharmakanta has to hold that consciousness is permanent and unchanging, since the self by definition is permanent. And that sets him against both the Nyayika and the Buddhist. So whereas for Nyaya there is a self, and it exists over and above consciousness, it's ontologically distinct. And whereas for Buddhism there is no self, there's just consciousness, for Dharmakanta there is a self, but it is just consciousness. So it's as though Dharmakanta crosses out the line underneath Nyaya, but then joins up the dots, denoting consciousness. He travels quite a long way down the path of Buddhist argumentation. He reduces the self to consciousness, but he then argues that consciousness is unchanging. So whereas between Nyaya and Buddhism it was a debate about the existence or non-existence of an entity, namely a self over and above consciousness, the debate between Dharmakanta and Buddhism is a bit different. In that debate there's no disagreement about what exists. What exists is consciousness, and the question is just how to classify that, whether as something permanent and unchanging or as something momentary and changing. Okay, we'll forget about Nyaya for the rest of the talk, and we'll just focus now on Dharmakanta's argument against Buddhism. So Dharmakanta begins his dialogue with the Buddhists by saying, surely even you Buddhists agree that as we proceed through life experiencing various objects of perception, the perceiver of those objects appears to us always as the same. The perceiver of our various different objects of perception surely presents itself to us as numerically identical over time, because we never lose a sense that it's me who is the perceiver of these various different objects that we perceive. So there's a kind of initial argument from phenomenology where there's an appeal to a phenomenology which purportedly presents the perceiver to us, presents the perceiver to itself as permanently the same, as persisting through time, and as unchanging. Now, in his article, A Phenomenological Argument for Stage Theory by Josh Parsons, which I only know about because Jan mentions it in one of his books, he points out that there are two ways in which one can respond to an argument from phenomenology. He claims that these two ways are not often clearly distinguished. One can either deny that the person giving the argument has the phenomenology they report, or one can accept that they do have that phenomenology, but explain that it is the result of an illusion. Now, the Buddhist in this debate very clearly goes for the second option. The Buddhist does not deny that we have this sense of ourselves as one unbroken person persisting through time. They even have a word for it, satkaya drishti. And if it were not for the fact that we had this satkaya drishti, this sense of ourselves as one persisting thing, there would be no need for a Buddhist path. So the Buddhists accept this phenomenological account, but explain it away. How do they explain it away? Well, what Dharmakirti and his followers do is appeal to examples to illustrate how this phenomenology is actually illusory. So for example, we could take the example of projecting a person onto a screen. We look at the person on the screen, we think we're looking at one unbroken, continuously existing person, but actually we're looking at a sequence of distinct film frames. But we take ourselves to be looking at one uninterrupted person, one person without any disruption in their existence. Or to use the example that the Buddhists in this period actually use, that of a very calm river, where what you're actually looking at is lots of bits of water rushing by, but what you think you're looking at is one unmoving block of water. So similarly, claims the Buddhist, when we experience ourselves as one temporally extended thing over time, what's actually presenting itself to us is a sequence of distinct momentary perceivers. But as in the case of these two examples, we're fooled by the rapidity with which each one succeeds the previous one, and by the similarity of each one to the previous one, into thinking that we're looking at one thing rather than many. So that's the Buddhist view, and now we have that on the table, we can look at Ramakanta's arguments, because they target precisely that point. They target this Buddhist claim that, to use the words of the Buddhist, we superimpose oneness onto what is plural. We superimpose permanence and temporal duration onto what is actually momentary. So Ramakanta's first point is to say that the Buddhist cannot provide an adequate account of how we superimpose oneness onto ourselves, how consciousness comes to be mistaken about its own temporal extent. So what Ramakanta says to the Buddhist is, it's perfectly plausible that we could be mistaken into thinking that a plurality of things external to us is one thing. It's perfectly plausible in that case that we could be mistaken by the rapidity with which they succeed each other and the similarity of each one to the previous one into thinking we're looking at one thing when we're looking at many. But what you Buddhists are asking us to believe is that that's happening with regard to ourselves. In other words, you're asking us to believe that every single moment of consciousness is somehow deceived about its own temporal extent and somehow is capable of superimposing this oneness onto itself. And it's not clear how or why that could happen. And Ramakanta's first point here is that the Buddhist examples don't actually instantiate what they need to make this idea plausible. The two Buddhist examples of the frames of the film and the river, in those examples, it's not that the frames are mistaken about their own temporal extent. It's not that the bits of the river are mistaken about their own temporal extent. So in those examples, we're dealing with a separation between the perceiver and these perceived plurality of things, and so there it's easy to see how this mistake could happen. But how could it happen with these moments of consciousness being mistaken about their own self-perception? So Ramakanta's first point is to say we shouldn't be fooled by these Buddhist examples into thinking that they make plausible what they need to make plausible. They don't instantiate something being mistaken about its own temporal extent. And secondly, this claim of the Buddhist is actually contradicted by other claims that Dharmakirti makes elsewhere. So Dharmakirti claims that consciousness in every moment has a non-conceptual perception of itself. And Dharmakirti also claims that non-conceptual perception is always accurate. So that should mean that in every moment consciousness is perceiving itself accurately. Therefore, if, as the Buddhist accepts, consciousness perceives itself to be temporally extended, then it should be temporally extended. Now, the Buddhists at this point could respond by saying, well, in putting that argument to me, you're assuming that this experience we have of ourselves as temporally extended is a perception. But for us Buddhists, it's not a perception, it's a conceptual cognition, it's a vikalpa. But that move is not actually going to work, because Dharmakirti also maintains, this is a view that goes back to Dignaga, that conceptual cognition, even conceptual cognition, is non-conceptual with regard to itself. Even conceptual cognition has a non-conceptual perception of itself. Vikalpakopi swarte avikalpakaha. Even a vikalpa, with regard to itself, is non-conceptual. So it perceives itself accurately. So a conceptual cognition is mistaken about its object, but it's never mistaken about itself. So just to sum up this first argument, we saw that the Buddhist doesn't deny the phenomenology, but explains it away. And this first argument amounts to saying that the Buddhist actually is prevented from explaining it away by the emphasis that Dharmakirti places on the accuracy of our self-awareness. This emphasis on the accuracy of cognition's awareness of itself makes it hard to explain away how it is that we have this experience of ourselves as temporally extended. And the examples don't make it any more plausible or explain how it could happen. They don't instantiate what they need to instantiate. Now, the second argument focuses again on this Buddhist claim that we superimpose oneness onto what is plural, duration onto what is actually momentary. So if we take the standard, the most common example of superimposition in classical Indian philosophy, that of superimposing silver onto mother of pearl. So you're walking along the beach, you see a mother of pearl shell, and you think, oh, that's silver. It turns out it's actually mother of pearl. You've superimposed the concept of silver onto mother of pearl. It's very clear there that you would not have mistaken the mother of pearl for silver unless you'd experienced silver previously. In order to acquire the concept of silver, in order to superimpose it onto what is not silver. But in a Dharmakirtian universe, in which absolutely everything is momentary, perceivers and perceived objects, where or how could anyone ever have experienced anything persisting, experienced anything enduring, in order to acquire the concept of duration, in order to superimpose it, in order to purportedly superimpose it on what is momentary? So that's the second argument. And now the final argument, and this is the last point of the talk. Just a brief bit of background to this argument. Ramakanta's view then is that consciousness can be extended, can be numerically identical over time, can be even qualitatively unchanging, in fact, for Ramakanta, and yet perceive a plurality of distinct objects. And for Dharmakirti this is impossible. This asymmetry between one perceiver and many objects is impossible, because for Dharmakirti consciousness is differentiated by its object. The very way in which consciousness perceives an object is by taking on the form of that object. So since consciousness has a different form with respect to every single object, that amounts for Dharmakirti to the view that consciousness is numerically distinct with regard to each object. Now, Ramakanta's third argument consists in pointing out that actually Dharmakirti and his fellow people in his tradition do not hold consistently to this idea that consciousness is differentiated by its object. What does he mean by that? Well, Ramakanta points out that in one moment the Dharmakirtian is prepared to accept that consciousness can be single and unitary, that's the white circle above one moment. Dharmakirti accepts that that single moment of consciousness can perceive a multicoloured object. Well, if it's possible for one unitary consciousness, one perceiver, to perceive a multicoloured object, i.e. a plurality of objects, why can't then, in the case of a temporal sequence, one temporally extended consciousness perceive a number of distinct objects in sequence? If the Buddhist is prepared to allow in one moment one perceiver and many objects of perception, why is the Buddhist not prepared to allow over a temporal sequence one perceiver and many objects of perception? So those are the three arguments. I don't think any of the three of them are knockdown arguments, but I think they're likely to cause more sweat to break out on the brow of the Buddhist than the Nyaya arguments. The Buddhist is forced to do a bit more thinking, I think, in response to these arguments. Thanks very much.